Hello, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Good People, a GoFundMe Heroes production. I'm your host, Kelsey Little. In each episode, we sit down with someone who's making a difference in other people's lives, or has had their life changed by someone kind. When Yasser Sela met Guinevere Mann, he knew he had found his person. They cherished their lives together and loved going on adventures. Then, in 2008, Gwen was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor, which doctors had no other choice but to operate on. While they were able to remove it successfully, Gwen experienced severe memory loss. Yasser stuck by her side throughout her recovery process until, 10 years later, Gwen was tragically struck by cancer once more and it ended up taking her life. Yasser has spent his every waking moment since then not only becoming an advocate for changes in the healthcare system, but also going to incredible lengths to honor Gwen's memory. Hello to all our listeners out there. I'm back at Gotham Podcast Studios today and have the immense honor of speaking with Yasser Sela. Yasser, thank you so much for being here today and sharing your story with us.
Thank you. It's also an honor to be here.
Thank you. Yeah. So you live here in New York?
I do.
How long have you lived here?
I moved here in 2005, so 14 years and change.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love asking locals what they love the most about the city. It's just interesting to hear people's different responses.
Yeah. So I live on an island, basically. Okay. And people forget, and I forget, but I live like right on the water on 11th Avenue.
Oh, wow.
So I'm reminded every day, like, you know what? There's water there.
Yeah.
And that's a nice feeling. It's freeing.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's this like crazy metropolis all around us, but like you just need to move like a few blocks east or west. You're like, oh, it's free. You know, you're free. You're near the water. To me, like water and like bike paths, I biked here. Bike paths is just a very free and easy, like laid back lifestyle. So I enjoy that.
Nice.
Yeah. That's my favorite part about New York. It's just they have really good bike paths around the edges.
Right.
So like, I think it's really hard to bike in the middle of the city, like between avenues, between streets. There's just a lot of pedestrians. Everybody's trying to get everywhere. Everybody's in a hurry. But when you're on the bike pass, it's like it's a different setup.
Nice.
You know? Like you're on a bike path.
Yeah.
You know?
I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up my whole life in San Diego, and it's right next to the water. And I never thought about how much like that. I don't know. I feel calmed by it too, I think. Like, I don't know if I could ever live anywhere like landlocked.
I don't enjoy landlocked. I have to like see the water. I have to know it's like there. It feels like free and like open.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're here today to talk about your incredible foundation, the Guinevere Mann Foundation, which was created to honor the memory of your wife.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely want to get into the specifics of the organization and what it does. But first, I'd love to talk about Gwen, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, of course.
What was she like?
She was hilarious. She's really witty. She was extremely talented, like when it comes to music. We're actually releasing an album, her last album.
Wow.
It's coming out on her birthday, on the 24th of August. Wow. It'll be on Spotify. It'll be on iTunes.
That's awesome.
She would have been working on this for a year. And she was really excited about having an album release party. and so she didn't get to do it. So, you know, we spent last few months like getting ready. We had like a couple of hiccups, but like it's happening on her birthday. It's gonna be at Rockwood Music Hall, which she's performed in before.
Wow.
You know, we have really good turnout coming out. I'm expecting people flying in from family and friends are coming in from Utah and Michigan and Illinois.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it'll be great. And so she's also a really talented writer. Right after she got her brain tumor, and she, in 2008, I know she, you know, obviously passed away from lung cancer, but that wasn't her only health issue. A big part of her life for the last 11 years of her life was that she had a brain tumor in 2008. She had it removed, and we can dive into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
But like she was always positive. Never let that hold her back. She went to, she used that experience to her advantage, not to hold her back or to get her upset.
Wow.
I mean, she, you know, she had retrograde amnesia after. You never walk away from craniotomy like 100%.
Right.
You have something that, you know, when they go and poke around the brain, you know, things happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, she went to school afterwards. She went to NYU. She went to Juilliard after that.
Wow.
She got accepted to Columbia. So she was really talented.
Yeah.
And a hard worker.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think when you have talent and you work hard and you have a positive attitude, you can do really good things. So she was really inspirational to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did the two of you meet?
On MySpace.
No way. Yeah. That's vintage.
So old. Yeah.
Did you slide into her DMs, as the kids say?
She actually DM'd me first.
Really?
I was traveling. I think it was in Puerto Rico. And I got like a message from her. And I was like, she was really cute. And I was like, no, this can't be real. Because like when – I was like, who's going to just randomly
– Yeah.
Cute girl and just text anybody like out of the blue. But I was like, okay, well, let's just see if this is, I'll play along and see who, what this is. And I've never been like catfished.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't even think that term existed. I think it was 2007 or something.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, it was early 2007. And yeah, so we just talked for a little bit. And then I got back like 2 weeks later. And then, you know, we went out and had a couple of drinks. It was, yeah. Yeah, it was like, it's one of those things where like you're just kind of new right away.
Yeah.
Oh, she's, we're good.
Yeah. This is it.
Yeah.
And then so like, how about the people she was closest to in her life? How do people describe her?
Definitely funny.
Yeah.
Witty. Just a contagious laugh. Just like a singing voice that would give you goosebumps.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was just very positive.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, she's somebody you wanted to be around.
Yeah.
You know? Never complained about anything. And she was great.
Wow.
This is a nice presence to be around. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing about her.
You're welcome.
So, as you mentioned, at a certain point in her life, she was unfortunately diagnosed with a brain tumor.
Yeah.
So that was in 2008?
Yeah.
Okay. What was that like for you guys receiving that news?
At the time, I was slightly relieved, actually, because, you know, it could have been something else. It could have been multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
It was an MS, and I was like, well, at least a brain tumor, that's something they can go in and surgically remove.
Yeah.
It wasn't great, you know, that they had to do that, but like, you know, MS is not something you just can take out.
Right.
So I thought that was going to be fine that way, but in that sense, but it was really, you know, she was kind of losing sight in one of her eyes
because of
the sitting on her optic nerve and
her
olfactory nerve. It was a meningioma, and so it grows out of the meninges, so it's not inside the brain. It was growing from the meninges, so it pushes up against the brain.
Wow.
It was on the underside, it was like a skull base tumor.
Oh, my gosh.
I think that's what it's called. It's the size of a tangerine. It's a pretty good size.
Wow.
So we didn't quite grasp how major that was at the time, but we just had to kind of move very quickly. And, you know, we mobilized real fast. And, in fact, one of her songs that's coming out on our album just talks about that experience.
Wow.
You know, of she's thankful for everybody mobilizing and, like, coming to her need at that time. So we all stepped up. It was hard, obviously, when we realized how serious it was. We realized how serious it was when she came out of surgery, you know.
Wow.
Because, again, we were moving so quickly to try to, like, solve this thing. We thought, okay, we pop out the tumor.
Yeah.
And then she rests for a little bit. And then, you know, whatever, back on your feet.
Normal, yeah.
But that's not what happened.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, she basically, you know, had a stroke, and wow. it was in the middle of the surgery because, you know, it was just her tumor was kind of just wrapped in a bunch. Like,
oh my
nerves
gosh.
Were just all over the. I mean, the blood vessels were just. It was wrapped around blood vessels. It was all sorts of.
Wow.
And the doctors, it's amazing that she came out the way she did and not worse, you know? So, you know, kudos to them for getting it. But, like, she was, you know, she had retrograde amnesia when she came out. And that was hard on that.
What does that mean exactly?
It means that she can remember everything before the surgery, mostly. But she has a hard time, like, retrieving memories after her surgery. But there were ways around it. Like, mind is something that, like, you talk to any, like, neurologist who's, like, brain specific, and they really don't know much.
Yeah.
They don't. They don't know much about the brain.
Yeah.
And that's, like, what we came away with. And they're like, well, you know, what can we – where's memory? Where's her memories? Well, I don't know.
Really?
Like, yeah, they don't really know. They're like,
oh my gosh.
Hippocampus plays a part of this. And, like, you know, we know that, you know, the neurons firing between, you know, the all the firing between neurons, that kind of, we know, like, there's something, you know, memory almost kind of like lives in different parts of your body, or like it stimulates you to remember things. You can't just, not all your memories are necessarily just sitting in your brain.
Wow.
There's like smells and things that will remind you, and it's just kind of like a gray area where they just don't really know much.
That's
about
crazy.
They know, like, they're what parts play, like hippocampus is a big part of it,
yeah,
but, like, they don't really know the process of memory storage and memory retrieval.
Wow.
And how to improve it. They just up till a few years ago, the idea of neuroplasticity was, like, kind of, like, not a thing. Like, you can't improve that. Like, it was just, like, that common accepted way of thinking of improving your brain was that it just stops after a certain age and you just can't improve it. But that's, like, that's old thinking. At this point, like, there's not a neurologist that will tell you that anymore. Like, neuroplasticity is a thing. You can make your brain better.
Wow.
In many ways. And Gwen just kind of, like, busted through all of those, like, old ways of thinking. Her memory just kept getting better.
Wow.
She found, like, ways to work with it. Tools, Google calendars, reminders. Because she was a musician, that part of her brain just was not affected at all.
Oh, wow.
Like, that helped her remember things and retrieve things. So, like, jingles. There's a reason why, like, anagrams and, like, jingles and stuff, like,
yeah,
work for everybody, because it just, for some reason, that's an easier memory tool.
Huh.
So she kind of used that to her advantage,
like, wow,
using those tools. And she went to some really great programs in the city. Mount Sinai has this memory program called it's for stroke survivors and people with memory problems. It's called Phase 2. Excellent program. So it's for anybody who, like, has gone through, like, a brain injury, you know, and just having, like, memory problems, like rehabilitation, how to tools for improving your daily life, or how to, like, you know, be, you know, part of society again, with arming you with the tools and, like, know-how and, like, just kind of, like, tips and tricks to, like, make it through. It's a pretty intense program. She went through it a couple times.
Wow.
Yeah. So, in summary, I mean, it was a shock.
Yeah.
After her surgery, because of all these memory problems. She never went back to work. So, you know, we made it was kind of like a do over for her.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, anybody else, I think, without her type of attitude, would just say, this is terrible and I'm just going to sit at home and do nothing. But that wasn't her, you know. We did a lot.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about some of the things that you guys did together,
cool,
like, to help her get through this time. You two started running together.
Yes.
Is there something about running that you thought would, like, help her through this experience?
Yeah. So we were trying to just on the idea of like neuroplasticity, what does that mean? What could we just were looking for any way to help her. So we studied and read a lot, you know, exercise, eating right, and drinking water supplements and all that kind of stuff that, you know, stretching, yoga, all that kind of stuff. So one big part of it is like, is exercise and running specifically. It's really good for like just getting your body moving. Yeah. And it's good for your brain in many different ways. It like releases endorphins, and it also kind of just kind of, your brain just fires up in a different way. It's just, it makes you happy, and being happy just kind of is a good environment for your brain to like grow, and it'll add to like all the other things that we were doing. So it was a key part of like her recovery.
Wow.
And like her rehabilitation process. So we just kind of ran with it.
Yeah, like that. Well, and then so you started doing it as a hobby, but then you took it to the next level though.
Yes.
And you started running marathons together.
Like, yeah,
a ton.
A lot. And so that was kind of my idea.
Really?
You know, she would tell you, like, I didn't want to run. You know, in fact, I think we had talked about running a marathon. We had run like smaller races with New York Roadrunners before her surgery, but we did not have a marathon on our horizon. In fact, I remember asking her a couple times, like, do you want to run a marathon? Absolutely not. but like after surgery, I was like, well, you know what? We're running. Why don't we set a big goal? You know,
yeah,
a marathon to us, a marathon's like equivalent of climbing Mount Everest,
yeah.
You know, to most people.
Yeah.
It feels different to me now.
Right. Of
course. But like at the time, it was like, wow, this is like the ultimate thing.
Yeah.
You know? And so we're like, let's just set this as a goal. And it was also good for her to think, you know, if she can run a marathon, what else can she do?
Yeah.
You know, she can do anything.
Yeah.
So it was a good, you know, a training plan for, I also like a goal to work towards, because if we have a goal to work towards and whatever it is that we're doing is good for her. So I was like, well, just, you know, it'll be good for me to stick to a plan.
Yeah.
Because I like plans. So like, then we just got into a schedule of running because of that goal.
Right.
And then of course the psychological like benefit for her to know that she ran the marathon, of course, that's important too.
Yeah.
So there was like, it just seemed like an overall good plan to like plan towards.
Nice.
Yeah.
Also, how many marathons did you guys end up doing together?
Let's see. So we ran the first one in 2010, 10, 11, 12, and then 13 was Hartford, because the New York City Marathon was – didn't run that year because of the hurricane.
Oh.
So it was either 12 or 13. So
wow.
1, 2, 3. So it was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. 17. So it was 8.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, that's impressive in its own right, like, forever.
Yeah.
We'll get to why, like, you've blown that out of the water in a
bit.
But, like, I have a lot more questions about that.
Yeah.
But just to kind of.
Then we've run half marathons. We've run so many half marathons.
Yeah, you're like
count.
Half marathon, whatever. Just a run in the
a
park.
A lot of other different runs. Yeah. A lot of wacky races too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fun ones and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned too, so Gwen did a lot more during this time, you know, post recovery from her brain tumor.
Yep.
What were some of those things? I think you mentioned a few.
Yeah. So most importantly, we wanted to get her into any kind of rehabilitation program that was memory focused, that we can think about, any kind of, so we got her into, there was NYU Rusk Institute has a really great memory program. We did that for a little bit, but it's really just like a post-surgery type thing. And then they basically referred us to the Mount Sinai program, the phase two program, which she did for a couple times, met some really great people, formed part of her support group. She actually was in like three support groups, stroke survivor support groups,
wow,
and brain injury support groups. And that was also key part of her support system and recovery process. And then, she kept wondering, well, when is she going to go back to work and what can she do, you know, now? And I was like, well, you know, you don't have to focus on like making money. Why don't you just focus on, you know, what you want to do? And, yeah. you know, I got the money part. You can just take care of like, let's figure you out, you know? And so, you know, we know that she's very passionate about music, but also she's a really good writer. So like, so we looked at a couple programs, mainly at my like insistence. Yeah. I was like, I wanted her to like really, she needed a few nudgings to like believe that she could do these amazing things. But I never pushed her. I was just like, what do you think about this? And I was like, I don't know. She, you know, she just didn't know if she was capable of it. You know, she thought that her memory would hold her back. Of course, it would be hard in like a, in a academic setting, especially if it's like a history class.
Yeah.
What history is all about remembering things.
Yeah.
You know, that's terrible for her, you know? But like we thought about like, you know, music, you know, no problem there. Writing.
Yeah.
If it's nonfiction, you know, and writing about, you know, her experiences before her brain tumor, that would be like great for her.
Yeah.
And so we basically settled on writing, and then we found this. She went back to BMCC and finished up her associate degree there.
Wow.
And she got a lot of scholarships to NYU.
Yeah.
So I was like, let's go there. Yeah. And then and I just kind of was like in charge of like getting her the scholarships. She was just doing her work, and I just made sure she was funded. And she just – I took care of all the operational stuff yeah. for her, and she just got to focus on being creative. And so every year she just kept, you know, getting excellent grades, working really hard. She earned those scholarships. They were all academic scholarships.
Wow.
They weren't based on, like, her disability or anything like that. Which is great. And we never took out a loan. You know, we just, you know, any gaps in the money, we just kind of like, I filled them.
Yeah.
And, you know, she earned, after she earned her degree, she graduated with honors from NYU.
Wow.
It wasn't easy for her. But, you know, she didn't have to, you know, use her memory
yeah.
deficits. She didn't hold her back. So we tried as much as we can to just pick the classes where it was just all about purely her creativity. And she did great. And then she got into Columbia's MFA program.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. She was an she got accepted
wow.
to an Ivy League.
Damn.
I know. I know. So it was just inspirational. But she actually got rejected the first time. And then, like, it wasn't because, you know, her writing. It was you know, it's just a very, it's, they don't accept a ton of people.
Right.
So it's a very small program. So I was like, okay, why don't you take a year to focus on your music? I was like, what else do you want to do? And she's like, I want to do music. So I was like, okay, well, Juilliard has this really nice evening program.
Yeah.
Why don't you take some classes there, pick whatever you want, and let's do that. And she's like, yeah, that's great. Juilliard's very hard.
Yeah.
very hard.
Yeah.
Even for an evening class. And, during that time, we, you know, refined her portfolio, writing portfolio, and it was great that she got to focus on her music. And then we applied to the MFA program, you know, made sure her portfolio was tight, and she got in.
Wow.
You know, she was, I think it was only like 20 students or 30 students.
Oh my gosh.
It was very small. MFA nonfiction writing program. Actually, I'm not sure how many got in, but it's not a lot.
Yeah.
Like, they all fit in, like,
Columbia.
A small room.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah. So, super, super proud of her. And she was supposed to attend in the fall of 2018. And she, you know, she passed away in July
yeah.
of 2018. So, right a couple months before she was, September.
That's awful.
Like, a month and a half before she was supposed to start. But she got the satisfaction and the and the joy of knowing that she got into an Ivy League.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, clearly she was an incredible person in many respects.
Yeah.
But like you mentioned, almost a decade after she was recovered from her brain tumor, she got another really awful diagnosis. Yep. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, we had just bought our house in Brooklyn, and, you know, she just had this – she wouldn't, like, finish her – she always finished her, like, plate of food. Like, we would always have, you know, just the right amount of food. And I just noticed that she just wasn't eating everything on her plate. And I was like, that's just not you. Something's off.
Yeah.
And I insisted that she went and go and check get checked out. And after a couple of doctor visits, you know, things still weren't right. She would just – I remember one day she just like needed to just – we were sitting eating breakfast. She had to run to the bathroom just – I don't know where, just needed to vomit. It just came out of nowhere. Man. I was like, there's something way off here. And then, you know, we got it – and she had some pain in her side. And we had – you know, we got one doctor asked for got a chest scan or her abdomen scan, like to see what was going on, and they just saw part of her liver was in the picture, and they just saw what looked like metastatic tumors.
Oh my God.
You know, so then we got a full scan, a full PET scan, full body PET scan, which I believe everybody should be getting every year.
Yeah.
Like a full body MRI every year should be part of like the standard of care.
Yeah.
We can get into that. In fact, that's part of the mission of the foundation.
Definitely.
It's totally would shake things up. It's very disruptive.
Yeah.
Idea. But I think it's supposed to, I believe, like, that's the standard of care.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, but we'll get there. We had, I pushed and pushed, and I was like, I got her into a PET scan, and then they saw that she had lung cancer.
Gosh.
You know, like tumors all over her lungs. It was stage 4 on her spine, on her, just everywhere. Liver was just covered, and, you know, she was asymptomatic. Like in mid-May in 2018, she was going for her regular MRI of her brain. She was going to MSK, you know, one of the finest cancer centers in the world. And she would go through every 3 or 4 months for 10 years. She would go and get her brain scanned, an MRI. There's nothing... Nothing showed up, and like they, you know, she was seeing a doctor a cancer doctor every 3 or 4 months, and we'd get our annual physicals, she was just asymptomatic.
Wow.
Even 2 weeks before her cancer diagnosis, there was nothing like really that set off alarms to the doctors until, you know, we got that PET scan in late 2 weeks later.
Wow.
Of her body. So, and then it was just, from that point, it was just crisis mode for almost two months. She was in and out of the hospital for like 4 or 5 times a week at a time.
Oh my God.
You know, I didn't go to work for a couple months, you know, of course I wouldn't, but, there was no sleep, you know, there was like, what can we do to save her? Because a stage 4 lung cancer diagnosis really is a death sentence unless, you know, things really, really change in the drug pipeline.
Yeah.
But right now, it's just so many things that are wrong with the way that we treat lung cancer now, starting at like early detection systems and awareness among the population, awareness among doctors. You know, it's just completely messed up. You know, the 5-year survival rate for lung cancer right now is one of the lowest. I believe it's like 4 or 5%.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, so just for perspective, like breast cancer, not because it's an easier cancer, it used to also be a death sentence, but breast cancer is now in the upper 90s, you know, because of early detection. Because of
preventative screenings and stuff.
Because of preventative screening. Better drugs, everything. It's a much more better funded, higher awareness
yeah.
among doctors, among patients.
Yeah.
We have a long ways to go on on lung cancer.
Yeah.
And there's also stigmas behind it. You know, like the lung cancer Gwen got was this cancer called an exon 20 mutation, which generally strikes, they don't know why. Again, they don't know much about lung cancer, not compared to other cancers. It primarily strikes like endurance athletes, non-smokers, Asian women. And it's just, there's not a lot known, but it's a non-smoker's cancer.
Yeah.
And you're seeing a lot more of that because there's more, there's a lot less smokers right. in the population percentage wise. So you just mathematically, you're going to get a higher percentage of people who are non-smokers.
Wow.
And so good or bad, you know, the focus is going to change, but like nothing's going to change unless like you make it change. Like things just don't change by themselves.
Right.
Especially when it comes to like, you know, cancers and funding.
Yeah.
And inertia.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Well, in July of last year, you faced an unimaginable loss.
Yep.
Gwen lost her second battle to cancer. And I just want to take a moment to say how truly sorry I am.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just can't express my condolences enough. I'm really sorry.
Appreciate it.
So after losing Gwen, you were inspired to start your foundation, which is named after her. I would love to talk more about that. So what is the goal of the Gwen Mann Foundation? What work do you guys do?
Okay, so first of all, Gwen and I actually talked about like the foundation before she passed away. And you know, the goal was to run it together. We were supposed to get her to remission and just, you know, do good work. We didn't really know what the goal was at the time. I just knew that we wanted to help people going through lung cancer and brain tumor. But I've, you know, refined it after she passed away. And, but in the same spirit to help those two areas. And that is through, number one, preventing it from ever happening, getting to stage four. And number two, to help the survivors, like in Gwen's situation, like after brain tumor, she thrived.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't, you know, like, this is it, I'm done, I'm in a downhill decline. So just in general, objectives is number one, to, you know, get the survival rate of lung cancer to equivalent of what like breast cancer is right now in the upper 90s. So we got a long way to go, and I'll get into the specifics of that. And number two, through education, because education was a big part of what Guinevere did to get better and to inspire herself and to inspire me and to inspire other people. To, you know, to work on your passions and to get better. So those are the two general tracks. So within the first one, our main goal is to use the current technology that we have through partners. Like we're doing a couple of programs with, number one, with the American Cancer Society. And number two, right now we're very excited that we're about to partner with the Weill Cornell, with Weill Cornell Hospital, with their incredible lung screening program over there around Lung Cancer Awareness Month, which is in November. More details are going to come in the next few weeks. Yes. But we're very excited about using current technology to screen people.
Wow.
So the New York City Marathon is going to be technically my 51st marathon. I know we're going to get into this in a second.
Oh, my God, yeah.
My 51st marathon in the last 365 days. And so we're going to cap off both the finale of my 50 marathons of 50 states tour, as well as launching Lung Cancer Awareness Month and then launching into this lung screening program that we've been like just itching to start. But also the bigger issue is not just getting people screened. The biggest issue that I've discovered through talking to these eminent lung screening programs run by doctors who really obviously know what they're talking about, is there's an awareness problem. Mm-hmm. So the awareness problem is that even amongst the strict guidelines, which are outdated, and we can get into that in a minute, is amongst that population, if you're over 55 or you are a previous smoker, and there's like pretty high limits to like just getting screened.
Yeah.
Like these guidelines just don't make sense anymore. Guinevere wouldn't fall into it. And we know more about lung cancer now that these guidelines are just completely outdated. But regardless, within those guidelines, only 2% of those people who are eligible to be screened are getting screened. So
wow,
that's
not enough.
You're not going to get anywhere if even those people aren't getting screened.
Right.
And those are smokers. Yeah. So there's a whole bigger part of the population that needs to get screened. So that's the other part of what we're doing, is through these partnering with Weill Cornell and other like-minded lung screening programs to help raise awareness. And the good thing about what we've already done by me, like I've gone to 36 states as of today. Everywhere I go, I spread this message.
Yeah.
Where like, just go get screened.
Yeah.
That's thankfully, like I thought I was doing nothing by like just getting on TV and telling people to get screened. But you know, I've got my work is getting validated by wow. like these lung screening programs, which is like, that's probably the most valuable thing we could be doing.
Yeah.
It's just telling people like, you know, this is a problem.
Yeah.
You know, go get screened.
Yeah.
If you think, you know, there's an issue, if you have a cough that won't go away, or you fall within these guidelines, you definitely should be getting screened.
Yeah.
If you're an Asian woman, they don't know why, but they know there's a higher incidence of non-smoking Asian women.
Wow.
Young Asian women. Gwen was half Asian, half Filipino, that are getting lung cancer. They don't know why. They still don't know why. So if you are a young Asian woman, you should definitely be included in these guidelines.
Yeah.
You're at a high – at least go talk to a doctor. Insist on an MRI. This isn't me talking. This is like – there's studies out there already
right.
that say this, you know. So there's that. So awareness track. And as we get more money and there's plenty of work for us to do. We will not run out of work. Hopefully we do run out of work.
Yeah.
But we're not going to run out of work for the next few years to get the awareness to the level it needs to be.
Yeah.
And then finally, we want to also improve the technology. So there are wonderful scientists that need more funding. There's this scientist and doctor out of Spain who's doing work with basically developing a mechanical nose. So to smell lung cancer on people's breath. There's this dog that she has. The dog's named Blatt. I don't know why his name is Blatt. But he's been tested. She presented at a lung conference midsummer last year, right after Gwen passed. And her study basically showed that Blatt can smell lung cancer early stages through somebody's breath, like 99.6% accuracy.
That is crazy.
I know. But like her job, her goal is not to breed more dogs and put dogs all over the place. She just wants to know what is he smelling.
Yeah.
So she's basically just going through like volatile organic compounds. There's like 3,000 different volatile organic compounds. She's just coming up with different permutations of combinations to see like what is it that he's smelling. So they can like this smell profile is that smells like lung cancer. She wants to develop that.
Oh my God.
So those are the people we should be helping, you know, alongside – I mean that's a midterm goal.
Mm-hmm.
So our short-term goal is like we got this technology, MRIs and low-dose CT scans, and we have a great lung screening program. Let's just save as many people as we can right now, get them into the system. We should continue funding these folks who are doing this. I'm very bullish on like mechanical noses. There's also blood biopsies and all that. I'm not super bullish on those, but you know, other doctors – you know, doctors can disagree, but like I've read a ton and I just feel like it's logical to put eggs in different baskets. Mm-hmm. But like I really believe in this doctor out of Spain. And then So that's that front.
Okay.
The other front is fairly straightforward. Like we'd like to fund endowments at NYU, at Columbia, at Juilliard, and at the the Mount Sinai Institute for their phase two programs. Mm-hmm. Once we endow those, like they're just on autopilot and we can like run from there. And we'd love to also, you don't have to just go to those institutes, those wonderful institutes that she went to. Like we want to set up our own endowment to just help people who have gone through these, you know, terrible diseases to continue to thrive. Because it's not just about getting people early detected. We want you to live a full life.
Yeah.
So those are two very important things. So we have a lot on our plates.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're accomplishable. There are things that we can accomplish.
Yeah.
And then the most one more thing under the early detection stuff is this is a radical idea, but we have to change the guidelines. And that will cause a cascade of change. The guidelines, meaning the screening guidelines for lung cancer.
Right.
There's basically a panel of like 20 doctors at the NCCN that set the guidelines for the screening for like what are the guidelines for anybody to get screened for lung cancer.
Yeah.
And that guides doctors, that guides insurance companies.
Yeah.
That like if we can convince this panel of doctors – based on studies that have already been published.
Yeah.
I'm not a doctor. And we don't need to create new studies to say you need to change your guidelines. That study's already there. We just need to mobilize. So our short-term goal is to save people now using current technology. Our midterm goals is to fund the scientists that are developing new early detection screening. And then finally, our longer-term goal is to change the guidelines.
Yeah.
And ultimately, is everybody, as a standard of care, should be getting full-body MRIs. And they can be done in under an hour. There's no reason why other than cost. I mean, if you pay out of pocket, there's this great company out here. It's a for-profit company in Manhattan called Ezra. I think they're doing great work. But it's for-profit, and you can get this full body MRI for like $1,400.
Wow.
So that's a portion of the population. Only a portion of the population can afford $1,400 to go get a full body scan that's not covered under insurance. I wish them the best of luck, and I think what they're doing is great. But like at the same time, like this should be just part of your standard of care. Obviously, we need to make a business case for it at some point. But like, I think the correct approach, in our opinion, is simply to convince the NCCN, this panel of doctors, that there's enough evidence, already published papers, particularly around young Asian women who are non-smokers, that they should be included at least in like first-line screening. Like pap smears, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like you're supposed to get a pap smear as a woman on a regular basis after a certain age. Now, based on like your risk factors and like things that pop up as along the way, they can change the frequency of when you get a pap smear. Again, I'm not a doctor, but like these same like guidelines could like apply for getting an MRI. There's a lot of pushback among some doctors, and because they're just following guidelines. And I don't fault any doctors for not for sticking to guidelines, because mm-hmm. that's all they have. They're just they have to follow the rules that are out there. There's just so much information out there. You just can't go off script and do your own thing.
Yeah.
But so again, our goal, long-term goal, is to change the guidelines, the screening guidelines. So we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Yeah.
So that's where the money goes. We would love for anybody who wants choose how you would like to fund us.
Yeah.
You want to choose education, right? Great. we'll show you the numbers. It's going to the endowments, and it'll be there for in perpetuity. We'd love to keep doing more of that. Secondly, let's try to save people so they can live these thriving lives. So that's what we do.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a heavy workload.
We definitely need more money.
Yes.
But the awareness stuff, I've been traveling on my own dime to all these different states. Not taking money out of the foundation, of course. because I am running these marathons for not just the foundation, but it's also a form of my therapy as well. We can get into that. But, yeah. Okay. I've talked enough about that.
No. Yeah. So another very incredible part of the story is your 50 marathons challenge. So, I think you're currently in the middle of it. You said like middle-ish. So can you tell us about the challenge?
Yeah.
Like why you created it in general and for yourself and why you're doing it, like what you hope people to take away from it?
Yeah. So after Gwen got her brain tumor and she accomplished the huge feat of running a marathon, I kind of got addicted to marathons myself. And the marathon turned into learning how to swim. I didn't know how to swim when I was a kid. And so I learned how to swim and I did my first triathlon, I think in 2011. And then I did my first Ironman in 2012.
Wow.
Gwen inspired me to do these things. So I was like, okay, well, she could do a marathon. I'm like, oh, I'm being a slacker here. What should I do to like set a bigger goal for myself?
Yeah.
You know? She inspired me to do that. And then from there, you know, I kept setting these self-imposed, ridiculous goals and projects. And Gwen and I would do this, not just me, but her and I would do this every year. In December, we're like, well, what do you want to do next year? You know, big goals, like general broad strokes, like, you know, where do you want to travel? You know, we would travel like for 11 days or nine days every 3 months because it's just like a week plus the week, weekends. So we'd do that, make sure we went to places and had fun. And then we're like, what big things do you want to accomplish, whether it's getting into a writing program? For me, it was a time for me to like set crazy goals. Like 1 year, I think it was 2016, I was like, well, I'm going to run a marathon every month. In 2017, and Runner's World covered it, which was great. There's a little bit more behind that. Is like I also at one point, I think it was 2011 as well, I really got into competitive eating. I wanted to be at Nathan's hot dogs eating contest on July 4th, and I was like, that was one of my, you know, there were serious projects, like getting into NYU. And then, like, there were wacky projects and there were vacation projects, ideas. So it fell into that bucket. And then, so, you know, things just got bigger and compounded. And she went to NYU, got into Columbia. And then, like, I did, like, Nathan's. I became competitive eaters. Just kind of, like, all these projects just built upon each other, you know? And then, so, you know, I was in when Gwen got sick in the middle of 2018. I was doing a marathon a month at that point until she got sick in May. So I missed my May marathon, and then she passed away. And then I was like, well, what? You know, I'm starting this foundation. Well, and I work in media. And I was like, and I know in order to get awareness for a cause, you have to create a spectacle, you know, to get like awareness, like, hey, what is this crazy thing you're doing? Well, thankfully, I'm into running a bunch of marathons.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just set this crazy idea, which if it scared me enough, then I knew it was going to be good.
Yeah.
So when I thought, I'm running a marathon in 50 states in 1 year?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yes. Yeah, it is a little
bit. I was like, well, how am I going to do this? But, like, it got me excited because I was like, this is nuts.
And
so that I knew it was going to be good. But it also made sense. It wasn't that I was going to – it made sense on multiple fronts. Number one, I needed to have something to occupy my time and keep me thinking and not just sitting. I work better when I'm moving, you know, like – biking or running, it helps like calm me and gets me in a good like mental space.
Yeah.
Like, so that was good. Like, what I get really excited about is when I do one thing that gives me like three different benefits.
Yeah.
So in this case, with the 50 marathons, it gives me the opportunity to move and to get into a meditative state by running, and that's healthy for me as I grieve. And number two, it helps me accomplish the foundation mission by actually visiting major metropolitan areas in every state, because you getting screened is a local message that you have to like put in every media market, because it's not, you can't just obviously we'd love to be on like podcasts such as this on a regular basis, but that doesn't always happen, and people tend to listen to their local news as well, and that's great, because I knew that by taking that message to every market, and I'm refining it and learning more, as this was an unexpected benefit, is that as I go to every market, I learned people gravitated towards me, and you know, pretty spectacular people that were giving me really good advice.
Wow.
You know, big time doctors, you know, cancer survivors and spouses of survivors, that, you know, this helped me form and refine the mission of where we're at right now.
Wow.
And know where the gaps are. And then, you know, the 50 states is obviously good for me to live and keep Gwen's memory alive. And that's important to me as well.
Yeah.
So saving people, getting the message out of what we need to do. It's good for me.
Yeah.
It's meditative. And then it's important for me to like tell people how awesome she was.
Yeah.
You know? So that's why I'm doing it.
Well, are you doing one this weekend? I meant to ask.
No.
You get a break?
Thankfully. So I get super excited when I get, I know this sounds nuts, when I get to do two in a weekend. Because that means, I know. It's not, I'll tell you why. Because it means if I'm doing 50 marathons in a year, there's 52 weeks there. It means if I do two in a weekend, that means I get on a week off somewhere.
I guess so. I guess
that's super exciting. And then it also means that, like, if it's out west, like I'm in New York, if I have to go out to, so for example, I went out to, I did the Mayor's Marathon in Alaska on June 22nd. This isn't quite back to back, but it's 1 week apart. Then there was the Kona Marathon in Hawaii on June 28th. So I actually got to have a vacation for the first time in a year. I just sat on the beach in Hawaii for a week and did basically nothing.
Good. You deserve that.
I know. It was great. It was great. And then so I got to knock out the hardest marathons to get to.
Wow.
Hawaii is very far away.
Yeah.
And so is Alaska. So I got to do those at the same time and back. So I like to find those efficiencies. Similarly, if I'm out in like I'll try to knock out like my next marathons, marathon number 37, 38, and 39. On Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Yes, there are marathons in the middle of the week.
Wow.
That's Nebraska, Wyoming, and then South Dakota.
Oh my gosh.
Super exciting to me because I get to knock out three very hard states to get to.
Yeah.
From where I am.
Yeah.
And I don't have to fly back over and over.
Yeah.
It's like the marathon part is the running of the marathon part for me is now the easy part.
Oh my gosh.
It's like flying there. And flying back and booking hotels and booking airplanes. I do all that myself. And, you know, we don't have the benefit of like assistance and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And we'll never need that. And we never will ask for that. And we'll never do that.
Yeah.
But like just saying that the marathon running part is not the hard part.
Yeah.
We got a lot bigger things to do. Our main message are those two things.
Yeah.
Which is get out there and get scanned, and let's get the scanning system better and updated, and help me fund, you know, helping survivors thrive.
Yeah,
that's the part we're focused on. This is just a vehicle for getting there.
Yeah,
yeah, the marathons it is.
You must have knees of steel. Have you ever had like knee problems?
Yeah. You know, when I first met Gwen in 2007, I actually tore my ACL, my right knee. But I would say my right knee is stronger than it's ever been.
And, wow.
And I lost like 50 pounds.
Wow.
Since I met Gwen. And so I would say my knees are better than they ever have been.
Oh,
you know?
That's great.
Yeah.
They have to be.
A lot of rest, a lot of yoga, a lot of stretching.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, ice massages. I get my feet massaged.
Yeah.
As often as I can.
Better.
Once a week. Yeah. That, those that works.
The ringer.
So good. In New York, we're kind of like spoiled. You can get foot massages for like $20 for an hour. Oh. And they're good.
Wow.
They're good.
So why is it so important to you to keep telling your story, and in particular to keep telling Gwen's story?
Because she was very inspirational. I mean, there's, you know, we even when she was with us, like we had an incredibly well-received StoryCorps podcast, and they made a short film out of it.
Yeah, I saw that.
And it was in a book, and it's because the story resonated with people. So there's more to – there's that was up till 2010. The story came up to – you know, that was only the first 2 years of her recovery.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, almost, you know, 8 years that came after that. And she's done more, and she inspired more people since then, and – She accomplished so much more, it'll benefit people to know her story. And you know, part of it is that, you know, I loved her so much, you know, and I love her still very, very much, of course, and I always will. And you know, it's a very obviously personal thing, and I want to keep her memory alive.
Yeah.
You know?
Are you doing a beautiful job of that?
Thank you. Yeah. So, yeah. That's why. Yeah.
I mean, you went over your goals quite a bit for the foundation, but, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. What do you envision when you look maybe, like, 5 years into the future?
Yeah. Realistically, we want to have moved the needle even a little bit in five-year survival rate. So we know what the five-year survival rate is now, and we want to point to we need to define this year with the launch of our first partnership with, you know, like-minded lung screening programs, where we want to be and how are we going to define those metrics. And then we're going to hold ourselves accountable. Like, what did we contribute to the 5 year survival rate 5 years from now? Even if we saved, you know, 100 people, that's fine.
A lot. Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah.
You know, but I would like to see, you know, I would like to set a number. I don't know what that is yet, but it needs to be something.
Yeah.
There needs to be some sort of movement. Ideally, we would have drastically shaken up what the guidelines, the discussion around guidelines. I want to be realistic of where we can't change things overnight, although I want to. Ideally, we would have shaken up the conversation around lung screening guidelines. And it has an effect. What we're talking about is not just going to affect lung cancer detection. It's if you're scanning somebody full body with an MRI, whatever the latest technology is at that time, you're going to see other things, you know, even if you're just screening the torso.
Right.
You know, you got all sorts – that's – everything is in your torso and up
mm-hmm.
to your head. I mean, things can go wrong in your legs, but really, honestly, the most – all the major bits are going to be here and up.
Yeah.
So why not just scan that on a yearly basis? Why not? So that's where I want the conversation to have shifted and changed by that point. And I want a metric that we define this year for us to have contributed towards moving the needle on five-year survival. To me, that would be a success.
Yeah.
I'll define the numbers this year with people who know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But like, I know what my broad stroke goals are, and that's it. Yeah.
I have no doubt you're going to make an impact. Yeah.
I hope so. Yeah.
Generally, I love to end by asking if there's one like learning or piece of inspiration that you would like people to take away from hearing your story and Gwen's story, what would you hope that would be?
There's a lot, but I would say, try to live your life the way she did. So, one thing we used to, and live your life with your loved ones the way that we did, because, you know, you have to plan. We had this thing called, you know, a yearly fun planning, that thing that we did in December, like planning for the year. We called it yearly fun planning, but we also had monthly fun planning because, you know, it's easy to get into a routine of like go to work, come home, have dinner, go to sleep, watch TV, whatever. But if your routine is to plan for fun and hanging out together, which we did always on the calendar every month, we didn't, sometimes, you know, things would come up and she would see something that she wanted to do. And we would both say, well, let's put it on our monthly fun planning to talk about for next month. If it's something that's happened next week, we would just go do it. But if it's something for the following month, we'd just put it on the fun planning and then like we talk about it and we schedule it and we're good. So I would say, you know, live your life the way she did. Always try to grow. Live by your passions as much as you can. And don't let small or big things like hold you back. Try to use it to your advantage. And, you know, plan times to be with your loved ones together, because thankfully the regret that I don't have is that I didn't spend enough time with her. I did. We did plenty of things together. So that part, I'm good. And I know she's fine if you asked her that. But, you know, I'm sad that I lost her, obviously. But, yeah, just remember that and do that. And I think you'll be fine.
Thank you again to Yasser for sharing his beautiful story with us today. If you'd like to support the Guinevere Mann Foundation, head over to GoFundMe.com/GwenMann. That's GoFundMe.com/GWENMANN. Thank you so much for listening to True Stories of Good People, a GoFundMe Heroes production. If you were inspired by today's story, please help us out by heading over to iTunes and leaving us a rating or review and subscribing to the show. And if anyone you know loves inspiring stories, please share our podcast with them. It means the world to us. Also, we love to hear from listeners, so if you have any feedback, suggestions, or questions, you can write to us at podcast@gofundme.com. And lastly, for more behind-the-scenes content and inspiring stories, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at GoFundMe Heroes. Quick thank you to Gotham Podcast Studios in Manhattan, New York, where this episode was recorded, and to our editing team at Cloud Studios in Seattle, Washington. We'll be back next time with more true stories of good people. Talk to you then!